Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The crash of 08 gave us a new vocabulary for talking about Wall Street and the economy. Too big to fail, moral hazard. And it gave us one big, beefy, controversial piece of legislation, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. It was never perfect, but now Congress is trying to revise it, for better or for worse, depending on who you ask. This hour on Point, major changes on the horizon for Dodd-Frank. You can join us on air or online. Do you think Washington needs to ease up on Wall Street and on Main Street banks? Does talk of weakening Dodd-Frank spook you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Erica Werner, congressional economics reporter for The Washington Post. Erica, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So help me sort of take a scalpel through this this proposal, specifically on the Senate side, on how they want to change Dodd-Frank. Let's talk about the big one that everyone's focusing on, and that is increasing the threshold from $50 to $250 billion in terms of assets that a bank should have for it to be considered critical to the economy. What's the Senate trying to change here?
Well, as you just said, that is the core change in their legislation, that those banks that fall within that threshold, $50 billion to $250 billion in terms of their assets, would no longer be subject to the strictest regulations by the Fed, which were imposed in Dodd-Frank. And there are about two dozen banks that fall into that category, and they would no longer have to undergo those strict stress tests and other forms of regulation that would be limited going forward to the very, very biggest banks.
Right. So let's talk about that for a second, because the original Dodd-Frank cutoff was $50 billion,
right.
And that applied to, what, 40 of the nation's 5,600 banks?
Right.
And now you're saying, basically, with this new legislation, should it become law, only roughly 12 banks, 12 of the biggest banks in the
right.
country would be subject to these stress tests and the most stringent regulations in Dodd-Frank.
Yes. And it's worth noting that in the years since Dodd-Frank passed, and it was kind of rushed into passage as a result, of course, of the financial crisis that happened 10 years ago, passed through a Democratic-controlled Congress, virtually on party line votes, some switchovers, but practically all Democrats, signed by President Obama. In the years since then, there has been a lot of even Democrats, and including Barney Frank, one of the original authors, who have determined, kind of realized that that $50 billion threshold was too high, in that, and that they wanted to raise it to $100 billion, $150 billion. However, proposals to do that were not successful because, of course, Republicans retook control of Congress, and they started setting their sights on repealing Dodd-Frank entirely, so that it's been impossible to make kind of the minor adjustments to a major piece of legislation that would be required in the normal course of things because of the politics
play. So, but can we take a step back here for a second, Erica? Because, I mean, we're talking about, as Dodd-Frank currently stands, banks that have $50 billion in assets, to me, that still sounds like a fairly large number, because most community banks are, you know, down in the $1 billion level or so. So I'm just wondering, these sort of middle-sized banks, what are they saying the problem is with the Dodd-Frank regulations that they face right now?
Well, now you're getting into the kind of crux of the debate, where there's a lot of dispute as to whether, you know, a bank with $50 billion, $100 billion in assets is too big to fail. So these banks, and they've had a lot of credit unions out here lobbying for them, these banks or branches of these banks exist in every state, and that's how you get the political pressure on lawmakers to make these changes. But they just say that they're overregulated and that as a result of the steps that they have to take to comply with the regulations on them, they have had to pull back from, for example, mortgage lending. In some cases, branches have closed in rural states such as Montana. John Tester, Democrat there, who's been a lead sponsor of this legislation, saying that he's lost a dozen or so banks in his state because of these regulations.
I see. So you mentioned John Tester there. There are other Democrats, Heidi Heitkamp, John Donnelly. These are folks who are also, they're up for re-election in November.
Right. I mean, it's impossible not to notice that reality, which is that these three Democrats you mentioned, Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, Joe Donnelly of Indiana, and John Tester of Montana, are all up for re-election in November in states that President Trump won by more than double digits. So these are red states, and these Democrats are facing political pressures and signing on to a bipartisan piece of legislation that's popular with community bankers, that a lot of voters know the banks, deal with them, they're in their communities. That's a political win for these senators. However, you know, we've all obviously asked them, does politics play a role in what you're doing here? And they point out, they say no, and they point out rightly that they have been negotiating these changes for a number of years with Republicans on the banking committee, but they've been unsuccessful in getting a bill, you know, to move forward until now.
Right. So I want to play a little bit of tape here on how this has split sort of leading lights in the Democratic Party in the Senate here. On Tuesday, Democratic Senator Mark Warner, who helped draft the original Dodd-Frank legislation back in 2008 through 2010, he told Bloomberg News that he expects broad-based bipartisan support for this proposed Senate fix-it bill.
Every major piece of legislation needs a bit of a fresh look and a review. And our focus, which gives relief to community banks and credit unions that did not cause the crisis in the first place, I believe will actually expand lending on Main Street and through a lot of rural and mid-sized town America.
So that was just yesterday. Also yesterday on the Senate floor, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts spoke out vehemently against the legislation. She's basically saying that it might bring the country closer to another economic crisis, and that that Congress is on the verge of making the same mistake it's made before.
The banks don't want you to know what's in this bill, because if you did know, you'd fight back. It was written by senators in back rooms and jammed through the banking committee, where its authors voted down every single amendment, every single idea to make the bill even one smidge better or to protect consumers just one tiny bit more. They voted against every amendment, even if they agreed with it, because Republicans and Democrats had locked arms to do the bidding of the big banks.
Erica Werner, how significant is this split?
Well, it's very notable in that for the first time of the Trump presidency, Democrats in the Senate are split on a significant piece of legislation. I guess I should note that there was also a split among Democrats in a government funding bill a few weeks back that involved the issue of undocumented young immigrants. However, this is the first time that a negotiated piece of legislation has come to the floor and Democrats are split. One reason for that is because Republicans, who control the Senate by a narrow margin, have been using procedural rules to pass pieces of legislation or attempt to do so on a simple majority, as opposed to the 60 votes that are usually needed to cut off a filibuster. So that's what they tried to do with the Obamacare repeal, which they were unsuccessful. And that's what they did with the tax bill, where they succeeded in passing that with only Republican votes. So the dynamic that we see here, where kind of liberal Democrats led by Elizabeth Warren split with red state Democrats is a dynamic that we had kind of anticipated would be coming up a lot as this session of Congress began. But this is really the first time we're seeing it play out.
Right.
So it's interesting to watch.
And we'll see what happens in terms of where this Senate bill goes. Erica Werner, congressional economics reporter for The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. We're talking about a major Senate proposal to reform and make significant changes to the Dodd-Frank financial regulation law. And now let's turn to another voice, Jared Bernstein. He was chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class. He's now a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Jared Bernstein, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Magda. Glad to be here.
I mean, just give us your, we just got 2 minutes here before the break. So first of all, give us your big picture take. There's been a lot of grief over Dodd-Frank over the past several years, but do you think is it in need of reform?
Well, my big picture take is that what you just quoted Senator Mark Warner saying made sense to me. There were some banks that were caught up in the net, particularly very small community banks, credit unions that shouldn't have been, and their compliance burden is too big. But what happened here is that instead of just targeting those narrow group of banks, the Senate bill goes way too far and ends up deregulating a large chunk of the financial sector that is tempting the very kind of fate that got us into the big mess we were in 10 years ago.
So this is are you saying that it's because they're lifting that threshold to $250 billion, or are there other parts of the bill that you're concerned about?
There are many other parts of the bill that I'm concerned about, but the most important is this idea that you're now taking a bunch of very significantly sized institutions, taking them at least partially out from under the protections of Dodd-Frank. I guess the punchline is this. Lehman Brothers was not the biggest bank on the street. You know, Countrywide Financial would not have been caught under the threshold they're suggesting. And that is tempting the kind of explosion we had a decade ago.
Right. I mean, Countrywide had $200 billion in assets in the summer of 2017. So that would have put it under the $250 billion threshold we're talking about now. So we are talking about proposed major changes to the Dodd-Frank financial regulation law. And do you think it's necessary? Is it time that some of these middle-sized banks get out from under Dodd-Frank, or are we risking opening the door to another financial crisis? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by the new CNN original series, Pope, the Most Powerful Man in History, a dramatic new 6-part series narrated by Liam Neeson that links recent news events surrounding the Vatican to their unexpected historical origins in the Catholic Church. From the start of the papacy to struggles with corruption to the challenges faced by wartime popes, go inside the Vatican to explore the roles of popes throughout history and how they spread Catholicism around the world. Pope airs Sundays at 10 p.m. Eastern on CNN.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. There are lots of places to debate today's issues if you don't mind getting attacked for speaking your mind or asking a simple question. But 1A is different. You'll find the 1A podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about proposed major changes to the Dodd-Frank financial regulation law. It's got some significant bipartisan support in the Senate. Does this sound like a good idea to you? Are middle-sized community banks really been made not competitive by the amount of financial regulation that Dodd-Frank brought along? Or are you concerned that the deregulation of some of the largest banks in the United States could lead us to the precipice of another financial crisis? I'm joined today by Jared Bernstein. He was chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, and he's now senior policy fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Jared, I just want to read to you a couple of quick comments from On Point's Facebook page. So far, they seem to be rather unified. Kevin Estes says, sure, makes perfect sense. Last year, Wells Fargo opened all these fake accounts, and now they want to loosen safeguards. Jenny Kay says, financial crisis ahead. Dwight Guise says, and they wonder why we've lost faith in the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. Dan Johnson, I'm shocked. Not. At least amongst On Point's Facebook users right now, there seems to be unity.
Yeah.
But But not all Democrats feel this way. I mean, you mentioned earlier, Senator Warner was saying that he's looking at his community and regional banks and saying they've been made not competitive by the
way
of Dodd-Frank.
Well, that's, you know, I object to that that conclusion. In fact, if you look at the community bank's profitability last year, they were up $6 billion. That's 9% over the previous year. So I don't think that the rules are hurting them in the way that he may have suggested. I do think that the cost of compliance has gone up for all the banks under Dodd-Frank. And in the case of some of these very small institutions, they don't need to face that cost to protect themselves or the system so much. So I think there's a point there. But I think the Facebook listeners are very much on point, to coin a phrase, and hitting the nail on the head. The big picture point here, one of the ones that I failed to make in my first set of comments, is that it's really hard to figure out what motivation there is for rolling back Dodd-Frank when, in fact, the banking and the financial sector have done great over the past decade. In fact, done a lot better than many in the middle class. And there really hasn't been any systematic kinds of the problems that got us into this mess in the first place. So if you'd really look at this and tell yourself Dodd-Frank is working. I was very interested in the fact that one of the writers mentioned Wells Fargo. Mm. You know, Wells Fargo was fined $100 million for their misbehavior by the one of the consumer protection bureaus that Dodd-Frank set up. Now, the Senate bill doesn't go after it, but the House bill, and eventually they're going to have to reconcile these two bills if they proceed, it certainly does. And we know the Trump administration is trying to kill that Consumer Protection Bureau as well. So the people who wrote in, they all have a good point there.
Well, I wonder, though, if are we at the point where not to be Pollyanna about this at all, but, you know, have the regulations in Dodd-Frank become part of the DNA in terms of how these middle-sized, and I put middle-sized in quotes, but middle-sized banks, you know, how they operate on a day-to-day basis. I mean, I'm seeing some CEOs of banks say, we'll probably keep doing this, but we're just glad that we're not going to have to submit 10,000 pages of reporting, you know, to the government every year.
You know, there's something to that. I talk to bankers not infrequently, and they always lead with precisely that complaint. And again, there's no question that compliance costs. I mean, they've had to hire new people in order to meet these regulatory rules. But we can't forget, this is often the case when we get to kind of this stage of the recovery, you know, 9 years out, 10 years out from the last time, we mustn't succumb to amnesia. All those forms that they're filling out, yes, they're burdensome, but they're there for a reason, to prevent the systematic underpricing of risk that happens in our economy regularly about every 10 years. And the downside costs of that are tremendous. So, yes, there's a greater regulatory burden, and in some cases it goes too far. But you have to be very careful where you draw the line. And the Senate bill, it goes too far, in not just my view, but I think it's a fairly a commonly held view.
But on the other hand, doesn't the Senate bill sort of leave room for the Fed to still retain the authority to ask for things like tougher capital and liquidity requirements for these banks, though?
That's an important point, and it's one worth emphasizing for banks whose assets are between $100 and $250 billion, so the upper middle, as you were talking about before. The Fed has an option to go in there and regulate them as if they were one of the biggest. The problem therein is one that we call regulatory capture. And what that means is that we actually had pretty decent banking regulations in place before the big meltdown. They obviously didn't go far enough. But we had a bunch of regulators who were asleep at the switch. And so what you really want to do is write regulatory legislation that factors in the possibility of sleepy regulators. And my concern here is that, especially looking at the appointees that the Trump administration is putting into these slots, including the Federal Reserve, where I think we have four open seats there, is that, yes, they'll have the opportunity to go in and oversee the banks, but they may not do it the way we need them to.
Right. Well, you're listening to Jared Bernstein. He was chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, now a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Jared, I want to bring in another voice here to this conversation. Tom Easton joins us now. He's American finance editor at The Economist. His piece on the new banking bill is called Small Change, and you can find it at our website, onpointradio.org. Tom Easton, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, so you heard Jared Bernstein's concerns. We're focused particularly on the Senate side at the moment. Do you share them? Is this the right kind of change for Dodd-Frank?
So I want to begin with what's really great about this bill and what's really great about the discussion. What's great about the bill and the discussion is it's actually on banking. And if you look at Dodd-Frank, I mean, that bill, simplification doesn't really assist you in the discussion about something like Dodd-Frank. It was 2,300 pages with myriad provisions that, for instance, on conflict minerals, on gender and racial demands on purchasing agreements, on, you know, just all sorts of stuff that was littered in that bill that had nothing to do with banking at all. And it created a lot of new entities that created a lot of the carried with them a lot of constitutional issues like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the Financial Stability Oversight Council, all of which kind of made it very, very difficult to discuss what we're really discussing here and what this bill comes up with is key banking provisions. So any discussion that you're really having between the $50 billion limit and the $100 billion limit and tailoring and all sorts of stuff like that, those are exactly the discussions that you should be having in a financial bill. And in fact, they were diluted in the Dodd-Frank legislation by all the other things that are in here. Now, it is interesting to note that this amendment that they're coming up with in this bill is very, very limited. Hmm. It doesn't really take aim at many of the things that people objected to in Dodd-Frank, like the structure of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, like the structure of the Financial Stability Oversight Council, like conflict minerals, et cetera, et cetera. This only looks at kind of very nuancical limits that are going on in the size of banks. And
can I just jump in here, though? But we just heard both Erica Werner and Jared Bernstein say that while it may be sort of a more focused set of changes, that those could potentially have very, very large outcomes.
Right. So Dodd-Frank was filled with stuff that had huge implications of this, of which this is one component. And this really was, I think, at the very inception, what people wanted. They wanted a regulatory regime that looked at things that could have caused a financial crisis. And this bill actually talks about that. And the discussion and the debate and the objections are all to point. And that's encouraging because whatever comes out of it will be better for the debate we're having right now. Now, Elizabeth Warren is obviously someone who really objects to what's going on, and she says the Senate has voted down every amendment, period. Now, last night at 7 p.m., I saw 197 pages of amendments in the manager's bill, and I have those in front of me right now, and I've been going through them, and I think some of them, you know, it's all nuanceical, but they're all important. The original bill that came out earlier this week that was voted on for debate, that's 248 pages. Now, I think, as I say in the story, in anything that long, there's going to be room for a lot of mischief. It's a fraction of what was in Dodd-Frank itself.
Okay.
So I think it's worth...
So this is really interesting,
yeah.
And Jared Bernstein, let me bring you back in here, because the whole idea of room for a lot of mischief among small changes to a major law, I think that is exactly what concerns many, many people, right? I'm looking at a couple of different parts of the Senate proposal. For example, banks, there's a proposal that banks that have less than $10 billion in assets would be exempted from the Volcker Rule. I'm just wondering why we would even want small-sized banks to engage in speculative betting. And then there's also the idea that these very small community banks that issue fewer than 500 mortgage loans a year would no longer have to do things like report income and race to the government in terms of who they're giving their loans to. I feel like those are small things on paper, but they could lead to very big things in the economy.
Well,
they certainly
can I jump in on this one?
Yeah, Tom, go ahead, and then Jared, I'll turn back to you.
Because it's really easy to say that there should be all those things in a bill. You should record everything. You should look at every loan. You know, the Volcker Rule, the provision, I think it's section 4049, I'm looking at it right now. You know, proprietary trading, acquiring or retaining any equity partnership or other ownership interest or sponsoring in a hedge fund or private equity fund. Many of these banks don't do all that stuff, but they have to be scrutinized for every sort of loan that they hold or anything that's in their inventory anyway. So, you know, a lot of this regulation is making calls on what is very, very costly for a bank to go through and try to prepare for a regulatory agency and what is absolutely unnecessary. And if you put a wide net, you have a problem. And so, you know, you were talking about profitability of banks and what the consequences were, and the bank profits were up anyway. But banks can achieve profits in a lot of different ways. And one of those ways is that they can stop doing things that you might want them to do. And another of the things is that you might not get entry that you might want. So, for instance, if you put any money in a a bank right now, you're probably getting almost nothing on your deposit. They've been making money because they don't pay anything on deposits and they get to get money for loans. Now, why haven't more people entered that space? Why isn't there more competition for deposits? Why isn't there more competition for loans? These are all things that on a market side would depress competition. There's an argument that a lot of that depressed competition comes because regulatory burdens are so high. It's so hard to start a bank. It's so hard to create all the forms that would require the reporting that you want, that you're just not getting a dynamic financial sector.
Well, and,
what
and,
does
and,
that mean?
And perhaps when,
that
you also,
means
when your competitor
small,
and perhaps, I'm sorry, Tom, I just need one jump in here, make a little space here, because I also just was thinking that, and that may, that argument may carry a lot of water, especially when you're competing against the biggest boys in the room,
exactly,
that, whose assets
exactly
are at $1 trillion dollars. Jared, go
exactly
ahead.
Yeah,
so I don't really see it quite the way Tom does. First of all, the consolidation of the banking sector did not at all accelerate post-Dodd-Frank. I mean, yes, there are fewer banks than there used to be, but that's a long-term trend. And as I said, it hasn't changed since Dodd-Frank. Secondly, I think Tom suggested that loan volumes are down. I certainly don't see that in the data. Credit is flowing freely. I totally, as I said earlier, agree that there are small banks engaged in compliance activities that they probably don't need to be. But your point that small changes can make a big difference is one that we really have to appreciate. So it happens to be the case that banks under $10 billion of assets don't really do a lot of the kind of trading of their own profits that would become a Volcker Rule problem. So the problem we had was very large institutions losing a lot of money and then having solvency problems. These smaller banks, if they engage in the kind of reckless trading now because they're out from under the Volcker Rule, that will still end up being a bill for taxpayers because they're insured by the FDIC, which is a taxpayer-funded insurance program. So, yes, they're not too big. You know, they're small enough that they can fail and not take down the system. But one of my concerns is that you're going to have big banks who are very good at figuring out how to do this, making their bets through the smaller institutions. Yeah. This is a kind of infection that happens in the system when you deregulate one part versus another.
Jared, I'm sorry, but I'm also looking at the clock. And before we head into a break, we've got lots of people who've got some important things to say on this. So I want to let them have their say. Let's go to Kathy, who's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Kathy.
Hi, Magna. In my earlier career, I was a certified internal auditor. I was an audit manager for what was then one of the largest 20th largest bank in the country. So I know some of this. In the mid-80s, when bank secrecy became an issue, banks were all up in arms. Oh, we've got the paperwork. We can't do this. It wasn't that big a deal. They're collecting the data anyway. It may be that we need to tweak the rules to make them a little less difficult for those smaller banks, and I say smaller because they're not small banks. Mm-hmm. $50 to $250 billion may not take down Wall Street right away, but it can take down a huge regional economy, which mm-hmm. will then start to ripple. And there are a lot of ways to get around if you don't want to report mortgages because you make less than $500. Well, you set up a banking corporation where they're all separate banks,
uh-huh.
and they each make less than $500. There are lots of ways that are already trying to get around the rules.
And Kathy, can I jump in here? Because I think you've made a really interesting point, and I want to get Tom Easton's response to that. Kathy, thank you so much. I mean, here we have a former audit manager for a huge bank, Tom, saying that she's worried about the regional instability that these changes could cause.
So I think she's saying that banks resist new restrictions and that this really raises questions about the structure of the banking system and what they do and what they shouldn't do and how they're regulated. But the fact is that, you know, all these regulations that are put into this bill come with tremendous cost. I think that Jared made a very, very important point when he said that lending isn't down. But the question isn't whether lending is down. The question is lending, you know, what is lost in these costs? This is a problem that Bastiat postulated in the 19th century and stuff. What do you lose by these high things and what do you gain? And we can see that if you repress all sorts of activity, you won't have certain consequences, but you lose something in the process. And this bill actually takes a lot of very marginal steps. Now, you know, it may need further discussion, and this is all good. But the fact is, these are not radical steps that are done on any of these things. Now, you mentioned that, you know, the Trump administration, that the problem with regulators, you know, with their that are asleep on the switch, but nothing really in any sort of rule keeps regulators awake. I mean, when Stigler put out that idea of regulatory capture, the notion was that a regulatory-based system has these flaws embedded in it.
Yeah.
And that's when Elizabeth Warren, I think, is really, really accurate. She says that, you know, there's been a huge revolving door. So what happened is they put in these very, very complex regulations. All the major banks that I know hired loads of these regulators to work for them. And you know what? These major banks really love all these rules because they understand how they work, and they obviously can do what this other woman was saying too. They can create all sorts of subsidiaries to get around them. Meanwhile, you have all sorts of other institutions that, as you mentioned, are just really, really it's very, very difficult, and they may cut back the activity they do, and you can't measure it. But if you listen to the senators, I think the only reason Democrats are really crossing the line is not just politics writ large, but politics writ large. These were people in their home communities complaining that whatever the burdens were, it was prohibiting them from doing businesses, and business and businesses themselves were complaining about the consequences to their banks.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We're talking about some major proposed changes to the Dodd-Frank financial regulation law. There's a couple of proposals in the Senate and the House. And on the Senate side, it's got bipartisan support. But that bipartisan support doesn't mean that the bill isn't controversial. So let's just take a quick listen here to Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He was on CNN last night, and he asked rhetorically why the Senate is putting so much energy into changing banking regulations when there are more serious problems to tackle on behalf of the country. His answer, he said, corruption.
Last year, the financial institutions spent $200 million in lobbying. Over the last 20 or 30 years, they have spent billions of dollars on campaign contributions. This is the corruption. What you're seeing is the corruption of the American political system. Big money rules, and the needs of ordinary people gets ignored.
That's Senator Bernie Sanders. On the other hand, during debate on the Senate floor yesterday, West Virginia Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito said smaller community banks really have been bearing the brunt of Dodd-Frank since the 2008 financial crisis.
They've been bearing the brunt, really, a lot of Washington's response to that in the form of Dodd-Frank. We know that larger financial institutions, they have the capital, they have the resources, the staff, and the expertise to handle a lot of these regulatory requirements that are placed on them. But our smaller institutions have really struggled under the weight of Dodd-Frank.
All right, I'm joined today by Tom Easton and Jared Bernstein. And Jared, you know, the finance nerd in me wishes that we had enough time to talk about things like changing underwriting standards that the bill proposes.
Yes.
And
yeah,
not demanding an increase in tangible assets for some of these institutions. But let me just step back here, though, because I think one of the things I'm really curious about is if we really want to make changes to Dodd-Frank, and there is appetite for it, what if we thought about it in a completely different way? And if the concern is to stave off an economic crisis, I mean, why not make threshold changes not based on assets, but based on risk and risk exposure and what the banks are actually doing with their money?
Actually, that was kind of a theme of Dodd-Frank. I think all this threshold stuff, it's so kind of intuitive that it's gotten a lot of attention. But one of the smart things that Dodd-Frank did, by the way, it was never perfect, and Dodd and Frank themselves have said it's worth it getting under the hood, as Tom has suggested as well, is that it targeted assets that were risky wherever they were. And one of the problems with this bill, and I will get into here's a little something for your inner finance nerd, is that a big problem with the CRAPO bill, that's the Senate bill, mm-hmm, is that it's going to exempt banks from the kind of mortgage oversight, banks that make fewer than 500 mortgages a year. Well, that turns out to be 85% of the banks. And of course, that was the very problem that got us into this mess, was these mortgages that eventually turned into non-performing loans. And even if enough small banks make those kinds of risky mortgages, once you sort of link all that risk together, you're back where we were before.
But doesn't the bill, though, say that, as long as these small lenders don't sell off the loans to Wall Street, so they'd have to retain them?
So that this is the idea that if you have skin in the game, you're less likely to take on a risky loan. And there's probably something to that. However, there's actually a ton of evidence that many of, in fact, that's why the banks had such problems back 10 years ago. It wasn't because of the loans that they sold off to some other sucker. It was the ones they kept on their books. So it is not correct to assume that because a bank has to keep a loan on its books, it will only make high-quality loans. That's a mistake that's embedded in this bill. And I guess the point that I'd want to make, pushing back on some points that Tom made earlier, is that, yes, there are, of course, costs to compliance. And as the senator from West Virginia was saying, I don't think those costs are as burdensome as she said they were, or the sector, including the small and rural part of the sector, wouldn't be doing as well as they've done. That said, of course there are costs. What you have to ask yourself is, have those costs turned out to be prohibitive in some kind of a sense that wouldn't make them worth what they're doing? In fact, what they're doing has helped to prevent the inflation of a credit bubble, which usually shows up about every 10 years. We don't really have one right now. If we go down the path that this bill takes us, I'm afraid that we're kind of asking for that problem again.
Well, Jared and Tom, I've got a ton of callers who want to get in here, and I have been monopolizing the conversation, so let me hand it over to them a little bit. Mike is calling from Long Island, New York. You're on the air, Mike.
Hi, Magna.
Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Listen, we're looking at a $20 trillion deficit in less than two decades. It's very hard to wrap your head around the fact that just two decades ago, our national deficit was measured in billions, not trillions. Millionaires decided overnight that they needed to be billionaires to be reputable people in the world. And we're looking at a loss of our middle class from coast to coast. The question I think you're asking in a roundabout way is, what would be the problem with letting the foxes run loose in the hen house? If you look at 2008, I think that's a pretty good representation of what occurred. And they're very interested in letting the same thing occur again.
Mike, thank you so much. I'm just going to jump in here and say, and thank you so much for your call, because I want to let some other listeners in here. But, you know, to your point, I was seeing, Mike, that the Congressional Budget Office assumes that it's 50% likely that some of the biggest banks will abuse some potential loopholes in the Senate bill, and that the bill increases the chance and cost overall of a potential financial crisis. So that's from the CBO. But let's turn to Sandra, who's calling from Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Sandra.
Hi, all. Listen, I just had a couple of quick points I wanted to make. I wanted to counter one thing that Tom had said a little bit earlier, talking about how there's been a suppression, I guess, of new banks and competition. And I just don't see that as being true, not on the ground. And I live in a small community between, it's pretty much a farming area between Madison, Wisconsin and Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And there's lots of banks and there's new banks starting. And there have been new banks in the last 10 years when things weren't even that good. There's money. There's a lot of money. And a lot of it is coming into these segments of society where they're making profits, and banking is one of them. And it's just sheer greed. I don't know why there hasn't been more of an exodus toward credit unions where people can own their own money.
Sandra, I'm going to just jump in here and say thank you so much for your call. Just for transparency's sake, we've lost the line to Tom Easton, and we are scrambling to get Tom back because I want to give him a chance to respond to what Sandra said. But while we fix that problem, Jared Bernstein, let me turn back to you. There's one question that we've received on our website that I want your thoughts on here. This is from John Evergreen. And John wrote that the last financial crisis was caused because the bazillion regulations in existence were blatantly not enforced. So Democrats decided the best way to stop the next financial collapse would be to pass a bazillion more rules and regulations that would not and could not be enforced. So John Evergreen saying maybe changes to reduce those amount of regulations isn't really the issue, but we ought to enforce the ones that are on the books.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I myself mentioned earlier sleepy regulators who were kind of lulled at the switch there. I think one of the ways to think about this, though, that takes us to the Senate proposal, When I was in the Obama administration, it was clear to us, and Secretary Tim Geithner at the time used to make this point all the time, the best, most effective insurance against the kind of financial meltdown that we had are very strong credit requirements. That is, that banks have to have enough of their own capital in between a crisis, a solvency crisis, and the taxpayer bailout. That is, the first order of losses should go to the banks themselves. And if the capital buffer is too thin, then the banks who make the risky loans end up cutting through it in a heartbeat. And the next thing you know, it's a taxpayer mm-hmm. bailout. So one of the very simple first lines of attack here is to set these thresholds, and above the thresholds just require banks to have a much larger capital buffer than they used to have. That doesn't require a bunch of regulation. That's just a simple line in the sand. And it matters a lot where you draw that line. And one of my points in today's discussion is that the line, the Democrats got a bit rolled on this one. It would have been fine to upgrade that line a bit, maybe 50 to a 100 billion or something. But by going up as far as they did, I think they're begging for problems.
So we have Tom Easton back on the line here. Tom, sorry that we lost you there for a second, but we had a caller, Sandra, who was taking issue with something that you said, and she sees a lot of competition and a lot of new community banks starting in her region, so doesn't see any problem with Dodd-Frank suppressing that. She doesn't think Dodd-Frank is suppressing that.
Let me take 2 points. For one, the line on the Economist magazine in terms of capital, which Jared said, is absolutely clear. We agree that the best thing to do is just ask for lots of capital. And that was in actually the House Act, the Choice Act for bank reform. And it's kind of a pity that they didn't go that way in the Senate bill. My understanding is that the Democrats were not really in favor of it, and some Republicans may have not been too, but that would have been a wonderful, straightforward approach. But going to that comment about competition, there have been almost no new banks that have started in the United States, despite what you may have seen. In fact, you may have seen branches start up, but many of them have closed. And I heard the end of her comment, which is she said credit unions are complaining. But in fact, she said that why don't people just go to credit unions because they're less greedy or something like that. But credit unions have been complaining about the regulatory burden as well. So I don't think that there's much error between the banks and the credit unions in this idea. And in fact, credit unions were driving a lot of the commentary that was going on the Senate floor.
So, Tom and Jared, I'm going to have to ask you both to just stand by one moment because we just got connected with Congressman Jeb Hensarling, Republican congressman representing Texas's 5th District. The congressman is also chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. And of course, while we've been focusing on the Senate bill, there is a bill about Dodd-Frank in the works in the House as well. And the congressman is a key author of that. So, Representative Hensarling, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you, man. Thanks for having me.
We just got a couple minutes here, but I'm glad you could make a little bit of time for us. I mean, just quickly, if you could, describe to us what the key difference is between the proposal in the House versus the Senate.
Well, I was listening to part of the dialogue before coming on your program, and indeed the House vision is we want bankers to be able to help capitalize small businesses, help capitalize the American dream, but they need to have a sufficient level of capital themselves. We believe the answer to maximum economic growth and to minimize the risk of financial instability is large amounts of private capital, not lots amount of federal control. And so we balance a deregulatory effort with very high levels of private capital. And so that's the basic difference. Now, having said that, I understand the Senate is producing a group of bipartisan bills. We have taken component parts of the Choice Act, and we have voted on them on an individualized basis. We're now up to about 4 dozen different bills that have passed with overwhelming bipartisan votes that would help our small banks, our credit unions, some of the regional banks to help let capital flow. And so we expect whatever the Senate produces, they're going to have to negotiate with the House because we have our series of bipartisan bills as well.
Right. Congressman Hensarling, though, let me ask you, though. I've been seeing people on the Senate side of things saying that if there are major provisions that come into a bill from the House, that they may lose the bipartisan support they have there.
Well, I don't know. I'm looking at a bill, H.R. 477, by Mr. Huizenga of Michigan. It passed the House 426-0. I don't see that in the Senate bill. I've got a bill from Mr. McHenry, H.R. 1219, that passed the House 417-3. I've got a bill from Mr. Holtgren, Illinois, that passed 331-87.
Yeah, I suppose I wasn't clear.
Bipartisan bills in the House. These aren't partisan bills. They're not Republican bills. They're bipartisan bills, and they're all about ensuring that credit flows to our constituents so that they can buy a car, go on a family vacation, send a kid to college, and the House will not be ignored.
Right.
There are two different sides of the Capitol. The House will not be ignored. We will not rubber stamp what the Senate does.
Right. Jared Bernstein, your response to that, particularly Congressman Hensarling's idea that it's private capital that needs to shore up these banks and not necessarily assistance from the government.
Yeah, I think the key there is that we're on the same page in terms of these capital buffers or leverage requirements. And as I think we've all said, that's a really important part of the formula. But it's not the only thing that's important. And so, for example, if you start getting too loose with some of the mortgage requirements, or if, as the House bill does, you go after the Consumer Protection Agency, then there are other kinds of holes in the dike. So this is a system with lots of potential abuses, but at least we agree on the capital requirements part.
Congressman Hensarling, we've just got 2 minutes left, but I want to ask you a super quick question and then give Tom Easton a little chance here. We've heard throughout this hour from callers and folks commenting online that they're very concerned that loosening regulations in Dodd-Frank is just going to it's being done for the greed of the financial industry and could lead us to another crisis. What's your response to them?
Hogwash would probably be what I would say. We are losing a community bank or credit union every other day in America, and they're not dying of natural causes. Again, a law that ostensibly was drafted in order to deal with Wall Street has hit Main Street. Talk to any community banker, any president of a credit union, and they will tell you this. After Dodd-Frank, this is statistically verifiable, the big banks have gotten bigger.
Mm-hmm.
They can handle the weight, the load, and the expense of this regulatory burden. Again, the answer ought to be more capital, a greater capital buffer, greater liquidity ratios. It shouldn't be that the federal government will micromanage our credit system. We don't want Washington in charge of allocating credit. That's what helped get us into the problem in the first place. Putting people into homes they could not afford to keep. It was terrible for the families, and it was terrible for the economy.
Well, Tom Easton, we've got just about 30 seconds here, so your last quick thought.
Well, I mean, on principle, the House Act was really exciting. I mean, it's one that, you know, editorially we thought really, really made sense. And it's kind of sad that those principles are not more fully embedded in our point of view or my point of view in what the Senate had to do. And, you know, everyone says politics is a mess and you do what you can. And it's probably good that they're doing something. But I think that this kind of principled stand of banking is vital and it's lacking. And, you know, I like the fact that at least the debate is on these issues now. And maybe that's all one can hope for.
Well, Tom Easton is American finance editor at The Economist. His piece on the new banking bills is called Small Change, and we've got a link to it at onpointradio.org. Tom Easton, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Representative Jeb Hensarling, representing Texas's 5th. Thank you so much, Congressman. Great to have you. And Jared Bernstein, a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thank you so very much as well.
My pleasure.
And last thought here goes to our listener, and Steph, who says, this is infuriating. We've got better things to focus on than relaxing rules for the banks. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thanks for listening. This is On Point.